Your Honor, opposing counsel, my name is John Tile. I'm here on behalf of Hal D. Hicks, the appellant. Harris Direct is a successor to CSFB Direct Incorporated, which at the time in question held a multi-million dollar stock trading account belonging to my client, Mr. Hicks. The account, unfortunately, was improperly froze, and for a timeline, this date was July 27, 2001. Harris Direct improperly won summary judgment and defeated a 60B motion by misrepresenting the facts and the legal status of its predecessor. Shockingly, Harris Direct continues down this path even on appeal. And still there are no facts that show what reasonable steps, if any, CSFB Direct took to protect Hicks's assets.
Well, let me just start off by trying to get my mind around how you can say that Harris should have known that the attachment order was facially invalid because it waived the bond requirement when an Illinois state court didn't think so.
On the bond issue, Your Honor, it all relates back to service. All of this relates back to service. CSFB.
But Hicks didn't point out the defect in service or the jurisdictional problems himself to the court when he challenged the waiver of bond, right?
We did point out the bond issue, which was in the state court, that was an issue that was relevant there.
But I'm talking about he didn't point out the defect in service or any jurisdictional problems when he went to court and challenged the waiver of the bond.
We did point out the fact that the court did not have personal jurisdiction over CSFB Direct. We did, Your Honor.
And you were there in that state court within 10 days or so of the date that Harris received this?
That's correct.
And didn't you have the opportunity to make every argument that Harris would have made or you would have wanted Harris to make on your behalf?
We made arguments that we felt at the time were appropriate. Unfortunately, it took until 2005 to get a lot of the documents from Harris in finding out that service was not actually properly made. That was part of the problem. CSFB Direct pretended all the way up and through today that the service on LaSalle CSFB USA Incorporated was a branch of CSFB Direct. And as the facts came out up and through 2005, it turned out that was incorrect. CSFB USA Incorporated, signing interrogatories for the garnishment, stated, we have no assets of Mr. Hicks, never have, and hadn't since. CSFB Direct, a separate legal entity, did. We didn't have those facts to make those arguments. Harris Direct did, but yet they never objected to personal service. We never found out the details of what CSFB Direct Incorporated knew at the time that they were effectively served. We didn't even find out that they were served via fax, or they claimed they were served via fax by somebody from Chicago sending it to New Jersey until many years later. Unfortunately, the $4+ million account was frozen, and there was nothing we could do about it, and they decided to do nothing about it, did not enter into the state court to object to service, and so we ended up having to sue in a separate court. The truth remains unchanged. Credit Suisse versus Boston USA Incorporated was actually served the attachment at 227 West Monroe Street here in Chicago. Garnishment summons immediately followed, and they were directed to Credit Suisse versus Boston USA Incorporated. Credit Suisse versus Boston answered those interrogatories and stated that they held no assets of Mr. Hicks. And those documents were not produced because they were sent to the receiver. The bottom line is CSFB Direct Incorporated, who held the funds and the assets of Mr. Hicks, who was a separate legal corporation, never was personally served the attachment order or any garnishment summons.
But if Mr. Hicks couldn't tell from the face of the order that it was being served on the wrong entity, how could Harris have known?
Because these were apparently two corporations that knew each other somehow, because a fax immediately went one day from one corporation to the compliance officer in the correct corporation, and they could have immediately, as in many of these cases, entered a case or told CSFB USA, we haven't been properly served. And then Credit Suisse First Boston USA Incorporated, a banking institution, could have then went down into the state court and said, like they did in the answers to interrogatories, that they were that we have no assets.
So is it your position that every entity served with a garnishment order must undertake a jurisdictional analysis before complying with the order?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. I think they have to look at, one, they're going to get garnishment interrogatories immediately following, which they did. In this case, they answered and said, you've got the wrong people. Now, with that said, CSFB Direct Incorporated, who held the assets, another legal entity described by both of these corporations, a separate legal entity, decided on its own to freeze Mr. Hicks's account. They never entered the case. They never entered the state court proceedings, and never entered an appearance. In this suit, Harris Direct made improper statements that misled the district court, such as the service of the attachment order on defendants' offices in Chicago was proper. Again, that's an incorrect statement. The order for attachment was personally served on CFSB, Harris Direct's predecessor, at its Chicago, Illinois offices. Again, a misstatement. The attachment order served on CSFB Direct. It was never served on CSFB Direct. CSFB Direct was a limited liability company wholly owned by CSFB, and CSFB was the only member of the LLC. These are the type of statements that we've been given for the last 4, 5, 6 years. Then when we get the full discovery at the 11th hour after summary judgments entered, we find out all of these are incorrect. And in fact, the true facts are credit CSFB Direct was an LLC at the time, or was not an LLC at the time in question. It was a corporation. When asked to produce a branch office listing for CSFB Direct at the time Hicks's account was frozen, defendant Harris Direct provided none that included the CSFB USA Incorporated, which followed a lot of the documents that were produced later on. This list of branch offices, which a lot of the cases follow, that state if a branch is served, even if it's not one where you maintain your accounts, can then hold the other bank or entity that's holding the funds liable, then you do have to respond. In this case, there's no facts that relate these two corporations together. And they both indicated that the one didn't hold the assets, but the other did. The problem is that CSFB Direct, who held the funds, never was properly served and never took one step to protect Mr. Hicks's assets. For these reasons, summary judgment should have been denied, and Mr. Hicks asked this court to remand and reverse accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Devereaux.
May it please the court. I'm Joseph F. Devereaux, Jr. I represent the appellee, Harris, in this matter, who was the defendant in the trial court below. The parties agree that the decision in this case depends upon a determination of whether the attachment order, which is the subject of this case, was facially valid on its face. In order to be valid on its face, the order must identify the parties, it must identify the basis of the action taken, the amount to be withheld, the seal of the court, the signature of the judge, and the attestation of the clerk that it is a true copy. That is all that is required to establish a facially valid order. The attachment order in this case, which is the appendix page 34 through 38, includes all of those six criteria, and there isn't a dispute about that. Let me say a word about this allegation that we have misled the court. The fact is that we filed our motion for summary judgment on August the 1st, 2005. Thereafter, on August the 10th, Mr. Tile filed a discovery request. We had difficulty getting the responses together and the documents that were required, but we went to the court. We requested additional time from the court. The court entered an order granting us additional time, and Mr. Tile had consented to that extension of time. Now, it is true that the court in that order also extended to Mr. Tile an additional 45 days after the discovery was completed in which to supplement his summary judgment brief, and the trial court decided the summary judgment before that 45 days had elapsed. But that's what the court did. We didn't do anything about that. The really important point is this. There isn't any question about who was served in this case. CSFB was served at its office here in Chicago. CSFB Direct received it from CSFB. With our summary motion, we filed the affidavit of Linda Rich. And in that affidavit, Ms. Rich states those facts in as plain a language as it's possible to do. The trial court considered this argument in deciding on summary judgment. Mr. Tile argued it at length. The trial court ruled in our favor on that issue. No, the trial court never found that we had withheld any information, that we had misled anyone, or that the facts weren't clear. Indeed, in the Rule 60B motion, the trial court specifically found that the summary judgment ruling was based upon a complete record.
Well, is your contention that your client was properly served under Illinois law?
Is it my contention that I don't know the answer to that, and neither did the trial court. It doesn't really matter, however, because defects in service can be waived. What would we have done if we did we have a duty to go in and challenge jurisdiction? As far as we knew, service was proper. And what were we to do? Tell the process server, you have the wrong party, go to CSFB Direct, located only a few blocks away. The only practical effect of that would have been to delay the process. The only effect of that would have been to permit Mr. Hicks to liquidate the account while service was being affected.
And your relationship at that time with between CSFB and CSFB Direct was what?
CSFB Direct is a wholly owned subsidiary. It was at the time a wholly owned subsidiary of CSFB. CSFB Direct is an internet securities firm. It was a wholly owned subsidiary of CSFB, which is a large international bank. But it is critical to note service defects in service can be waived, and moreover, we would have been liable if we had failed to notify CSFB Direct of this under the teachings of the Bank of Montreal case. It was a facially valid order as far as we could tell.
The attachment came to you directed to CFSB or CSFB Direct, care of CSFB.
That is correct. That is correct. And that is what happened. CSFB was served. CSFB then faxed it to CSFB Direct, and CSFB complied with the order by freezing the account.
So the direction was actually in the order itself. The direction
that is correct. That is correct. The direction was in the order itself.
Your client did not participate in the state court litigation about this attachment?
No, Your Honor. Harris has no dog in the fight. We didn't participate in it. We have no interest in it or knowledge about it, and we never participated in it except to the extent we received an attachment order, which we complied with. Other than that, we were never a party to the state court litigation between Midwest Transit and Mr. Hicks.
And Hicks did not attempt to bring you into the suit further?
Hicks did not attempt to bring us into that suit. He did not. Mr. Hicks immediately challenged the attachment order when it was entered. I honestly don't know if he raised the jurisdictional issues before in the circuit court or if he only raised the bond issue. We weren't a participant in that case. If he didn't raise the jurisdictional issues, I would suppose that they had been waived. But we weren't a party to that litigation in any way except to the extent that we received an attachment order, which we complied with.
Hicks became aware of this attachment order pretty shortly after your receipt of it, I
see. I believe that Mr. Hicks was in court when the attachment order was argued and granted, and he immediately commenced a challenge to it in the Illinois appellate courts, which a year or so later reversed the circuit court. But Mr. Hicks immediately took action, exercised his rights under the under the Illinois statute to challenge the attachment order. The question is, what is it that Harris should have done? There are two things that we could have done. We could have challenged the order ourselves. That would have been an empty gesture, in as much as Mr. Hicks immediately took that action himself. Presumably, he didn't make any better or different arguments than Harris would have made. The second thing we could have done was disobey the order, which is every court that has considered that issue has ruled that you cannot do that for reasons which are self-evident. We complied with the order. We didn't challenge it, but Mr. Hicks challenged it, and indeed he was successful in his challenge a year later. And as soon as we received notice that the appellate court had acted, we released the account to him.
So you think he became aware of it because he was present when it was issued?
My understanding is that Mr. Hicks was present when the attachment order was issued.
Did your client send any notice to Mr. Hicks?
About what?
About the fact that you'd received an attachment order.
No. But Mr. Hicks was, there isn't any question that Mr. Hicks was aware of this because he challenged it in the Illinois Court of Appeals. Mr. Hicks, this came as no surprise to Mr. Hicks. This litigation in the circuit court was protracted. It was active litigation. The parties were very involved in this case. Mr. Hicks was well aware of the fact that he was involved in this litigation, that the court had entered an attachment order, and that the court had entered an attachment order without requiring a bond. He was well aware of all of that. There isn't an issue in this case that Mr. Hicks wasn't aware of what was going on, and indeed, the record establishes that he took immediate action to exercise his rights under the Illinois statutes to seek review of the attachment order. And we know that he alleged that the court had no authority to enter the order without a bond. And it turns out that he was right about that and the circuit court was wrong about it. But here again, the judge was wrong. That isn't something that Harris has any duty to ascertain, whether or not the circuit court sitting in Lawrence County, Illinois, is right or wrong when it enters an order. No one has a right to make that kind of judgment standing alone. And we didn't. We didn't make any effort to ascertain whether or not the order was valid because the order that was served on us was facially valid. It had all the requisites of an enforceable order as far as we could tell.
What obligation do you have to Mr. Hicks?
At most, we had an obligation to prevent embezzlement, theft, We have no obligation to come directly to your question. We have no obligation to challenge the validity of an attachment order so long as the attachment order is valid on its face. We don't have an independent, separate duty to challenge a court order. That is under the Illinois statutes reserved to the defendant. And indeed, in this case, as I've mentioned, Mr. Hicks immediately exercised that right. He appealed. There was a hearing in both the circuit court, and then he filed an immediate emergency appeal to the Illinois Court of Appeals. And in due course, the Court of Appeals vindicated his position and reversed the circuit judge and held that a bond should have been filed. But I don't believe that Harris had any responsibility to insert itself in that litigation to make a judgment one way or the other as to whether or not the circuit judge was right. Nobody has the right to do anything but obey court orders. We have no duty, Your Honor, to conduct some kind of an independent investigation about what turned out to be fairly complicated jurisdictional issues. In the summary judgment motion, Mr. Tiles' emphasis was primarily on the bond issue. Before this court, it appears to have shifted to the jurisdictional issues. Now, these jurisdictional issues turn out to be pretty complicated jurisdictional issues. And indeed, the trial court went through each of them, and he evaluated each of them, and whether with respect to the service of outside of Illinois, does the UCC apply or the Illinois statute? The trial court pointed out, you know, there's a conflict here, and I think the Supreme Court of Illinois would apply the UCC. But for my purposes, we don't have to even get to that point. The trial court went through in its orders each of these jurisdictional issues and ruled that we would probably prevail on the jurisdictional issue. But for my purpose, we don't have to get that far so long as the order was facially valid, as long as it contained the six attributes of set forth in Millard for creating and establishing a valid attachment order. That is the extent of our responsibility. There is an Illinois statutory scheme that Mr. Hicks exercised, which gives him the right to challenge this, and indeed he did so. But Harris, as a stakeholder, has no obligation other than to comply with the law, to comply with the attachment orders, just as any other citizen does. And that's what we did in this case. Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is about to expire. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You have 5 minutes, Mr. Teal.
Opposing counsel raised a number of important issues. Number one, Mr. Hicks was not present in the trial court for the ex parte attachment orders. So strike one again. Harris Direct is stating facts that it does not know.
But Mr. Hicks was there, I think, by August the 7th, after the July 27th receipt of this.
We filed a motion under one particular statute that made the order invalid and against the law, which we
filed
did.
Filed it on August the 6th, didn't you?
Which we did.
And
which,
it was heard the 7th, or you filed the 7th, it was heard the 8th. It was pretty short. Pretty
something
short
like
order.
That, Your Honor. And we did win on that, just the illegality of the attachment orders themselves.
So how did your client become aware that the attachment had been issued?
He became aware that the attachment was issued through correspondence with CSFB Direct, and we were corresponding with them, advising them that they had taken the wrong action and should look into this, and that we were trying to figure out what the relation was between the two clients, or in between the two entities. In fact, the first affidavit from the compliance officer out of CSFB Direct stated that that she didn't know what the relationship was between CSFB USA Inc. and CSFB Direct. But nonetheless, Harris Direct can't stand here today and state that it owes no duty to somebody holding assets in their account when we have ample cases and statutes and UCC that are clearly analyzed in the briefs and will take too much time to go through. But one of the first things in every one of those is, and this goes to the validity thing, when these cases analyze the facial validity, every one of those cases, the first requirement is that there was proper service made. And in this case, there was not. And opposing counsel on behalf of his client continues to argue that this was a subsidiary of CSFB Direct when we have numerous affidavits from both companies stating we don't even know what business they do. That's a separate legal entity. And that's a separate legal entity. Who are we supposed to believe? It is their burden to put on at trial what the relationship is. They can't stand here without support when we have their own affidavits that state they're separate legal entities. We don't have anything to do with stock trading. We have to do with stock trading. But they can't just off the cuff state, well, because we have the first few initials, we're a subsidiary. They first claimed that they were a wholly owned member of CSFB Direct LLC. That turned out to be correct. Now, today before the court, we hear that CSFB Direct Incorporated was a wholly owned subsidiary in a corporate relationship. None of these have been proven, and none of them are within the facts of the trial court. With regard to one of the comments made that they have the right to waive service, they weren't served. And secondly, if you look at the case law on the service waiving service, the only time that can be made is if you go in and enter an appearance, you waive service. They never entered the state court case, so they fail on that level. Secondly, is if you take some sort of action in the proceedings, come in as a third party or an intervener or something, not entering as a true party, but you are taking action in the proceeding to possibly object or maybe ask the court what it believes, how service was. They didn't do any of that. Those are the only two ways you can waive service in Illinois under this situation. And opposing counsel brought up the Montreal case. Again, in the Montreal case, you have one bank served, and he decides that I'm not going to send it to the main branch. Well, again, that was a direct legal entity. It was a branch office. And so they claim, Harris Direct claims, well, we should do that. We should have done that, or that's why we did all this. But in fact, they continue to tell us through all of these this discovery and arguments, these are two separate legal entities. And the bombshell comes at the 11th hour, which we asked for 9 months. Well, give us your branch office. And CSFB Direct or CSFB USA Incorporated is not on that branch office list. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.